So I just wanted to begin with an introduction about who Bob Sadler is. Bob began shooting photographs in 1965 while he was serving in the U.S. Army in Vietnam. And, you know, while he was there serving, he was so overwhelmed by how much there was to see and how much there was to describe. And he wanted a way to capture what was around him, what he was feeling, and bring that back home as a way to express his experiences while he was serving during the war. And later in life, Bob went into management consulting, and that allowed him to travel to places all over the world. And, you know, he went to places like China in the mid-1980s. And he was lucky to get the permission while he was on this trip in China to go into Shandong province and travel to a small village and stay on a farm. And he carried his RB-67 and his tripod with him. And he was fortunate to be able to capture a few hundred images while he was there. Many of these images later transformed into a traveling exhibit that offered an entirely new perspective of China in the mid-1980s to people, you know, that were experiencing this traveling exhibit. And just imagine seeing that exhibit and juxtaposing that to images of China that maybe, you know, we would see in the news during that time period. It's really powerful. At one point in his life, an American family in the Philippines was hosting Bob while he was on R&R from Vietnam. It turned out that his family was living in the Philippines on an assignment for a magazine, and that a member of that family, William Hubble, was also a photojournalist. So during one of their conversations about photography, William leaned over and whispered to Bob, "Break the rules." So with that, we're excited to delve into your journey as an artist, Bob, and how breaking the rules has made all the difference for you and for what you've captured and what you've seen. And right before we delve into that conversation with you, I wanted to remind all the callers that are in front of their computers or have internet access that you can go to lightmoment.com. Again, that's lightmoment.com, and click on portfolio and then awaken, where there's a collection of really powerful images that Bob will probably be touching upon during this call, so you could actually see the images while he's talking about them. So I'm just going to go ahead and delve into the conversation with you, Bob. First of all, thank you so much for making time to join us this early morning on Saturday. I first learned about you through Richard Whitaker and the interview that he did with you on Works and Conversations. And it was such an amazing interview. Some of the stories that came to light in that interview really just inspired me to reach out to you and invite you to this call. So thank you.
Thank you for such a warm welcome and introduction. I really appreciate it. And I'm just so pleased to join all of you this morning.
Mm-hmm. So, as you know, as part of your introduction, I shared about this discovery of photography while you were serving in Vietnam. So maybe we could begin the conversation with that. If you could share a little bit more about your first experiences with photography and what, you know, it seems that you had carried this camera with you when you went out there to serve, and what really prompted you to pick that up and capture what was happening around you through, you know, through the lens of this tool.
Well, I was very young, just about 20 years old, had not seen much of the world, and suddenly found myself halfway around the world in a very different place. And I was just awestruck by the beauty of that country. And very quickly, I decided I would go out and get a camera. So I went to the local exchange and talked to the guy behind the camera bar. And he said, you know, why don't you take this camera? It was only $35, and it was a twin lens reflex medium format camera, which is much different than a 35 millimeter camera. But I knew nothing about cameras at all, so I just took his advice. It certainly wasn't very much money, and he sold me a couple rolls of film and showed me basically how to use it. And I just went out into the local village and started taking pictures. Mm-hmm. And, of course, in those days, you wouldn't see the photograph for weeks because you had to send it away and get developed and came back. But when it came back, they came back as these beautiful medium format transparencies, color transparencies. And although I had no way to show them, no slide projector for something like that, you could hold them up to the sky and see. And I was just stunned by the richness of those transparencies and the sharpness of those photographs, and just started taking pictures everywhere I could. And you know, compiling them and sending them back home. Mm. And just about that time, as you said in your introduction, I went off to the Philippines on rest and recuperation and then ran into William Hubble. And in the period that I was with him, basically got a workshop in photography one-on-one with somebody who had shot for National Geographic and a whole lot of other great magazines. And he took me seriously because he saw the camera. We saw that I was shooting with a medium format camera. I was somehow elevated in his mind beyond what I was. And he spent a lot of time. And then I still had 6 months to go in Vietnam. But now I had the instruction of a good photojournalist and a reasonably good camera.
Yeah.
I just kept shooting pictures the whole time.
So, you know, in that share, I had two thoughts that came up. I'm just imagining the context that you're in, and I sense a profound juxtaposition between seeing Vietnam and all the beauty that you described behind the lens of this camera and experiencing Vietnam as a soldier with, you know, death and blood and fear around you. I read some very poignant and powerful stories that you shared about your time in Vietnam in your personal blog. So how did this juxtaposition impact your psyche and your artistic eye while you were there?
You know, it's pretty hard to explain, but I just see things that I feel passionate about. And that tends not to be war. It tends to be the best of life. And when I had the camera in my hand, I aimed it at things that I found beautiful and that lit me up. And I was not an experienced photographer. And if you see the portfolio on lightmoment.com, that's L-I-G-H-T, moment, one word, .com. In the Awakened portfolio, I've put a couple of those images. One is called Vin Long Sunset, where obviously I'm struck by the sunset, but of course there's helicopters on the runway in the picture as well, but to me it's all beautiful. The Vietnamese girl is also from that same roll of film, and that was my first roll of film.
Mm-hmm.
And so in taking her picture, it's not anybody I knew. She was just somebody who saw me walking around with a camera. I did a number of sign language-y things, and she posed for the picture. Mm. But I didn't. And it was just a nice portrait. But when I saw it about 10 years ago, doing Photoshop for the first time on that photograph, and I went close on the hands, And if it's on your screen, you can enlarge that probably and go to the hands, and you'll see that she's got a rifle cartridge in her hand, which
wow.
at the time I didn't know. But it alters the image considerably because
yeah.
there's so much beauty in that picture and innocence, and at the same time a reminder of war. And I think almost all the pictures I took during that period ended up with the same thing, and that is I went for what I love about life, but there's this little tinge of war throughout them that I didn't even notice in many cases at the time.
That picture is astonishing, just the contrast of the expression on her face and the rifle that she's holding as if it's a toy that she came across while she was walking. And so, I'm wondering, before you went to Vietnam, did you have this calling within you to find an artistic way to express what you were experiencing in your life? Or was it just being in Vietnam in such a different culture, an incredibly different context, that awakened this thirst, I suppose, within you?
I think it was the dramatic shift in location that sort of turned me on to doing this.
Mm-hmm.
I always had dabbled a little bit with sketching and music and so forth, but not really put myself out there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that makes me wonder, because something that I dabble in from time to time is writing, and I always find how whenever I step outside of my box and find opportunities to travel, that writer in me is awakened again, because my senses are alert to everything's just so different. And so it's almost as if my senses come out of their slumber. And, you know, even when I travel and then I come back to my regular routine and my home here in Berkeley, everything looks new to me for a couple of weeks, or if I'm lucky, you know, a couple of months, and I'm able to really express that through words. So after your service in Vietnam, how did you keep that inspiration alive? I know that you went into management consulting, and that allowed you to travel quite a bit. Was that a part of what kept the inspiration alive? And if so, can you talk a little bit about some of the countries that you traveled to and what you were inspired to capture during those trips?
Yes, I think there was about a 10-year period after Vietnam in which I went back to college and got a degree and taught school for a few years, and then that experience led me to doing community organizing, and I became a community organizer and went around the country quite a bit. So I got to see a lot of cities in the United States as a community organizer. Didn't have much time to take photographs, but was always interested, always stopping at galleries, always stopping at photography stores and talking to people. My job as a community organizer morphed into management consulting, and I started working with other organizations and corporations. And those organizations and corporations were around the world, so I got to travel more in the United States and Europe and Asia. And for the rest of my career, got around to all of those places. I was never able to take enough time to photograph. It was so hard managing a family and doing that kind of travel that I didn't take any extra time in those cities or countries that I was traveling to. But I loved being in different cultures, loved the rapid succession of being in different places, different cultures, different situations, and felt very alive in the world. And even if I had a camera, I would get out and start taking pictures. But that would serve to train my eye more. And then when I didn't have a camera in my hand, I was still taking pictures. Every hour or so, there was something I'd see and say, if I had a camera, I would shoot that. And it's still in my head. And so I realized that photography was primarily a way of seeing better. And the more I had a camera in my hand, the more I saw better all the time. And as I got older, I took more time and studied a little bit more, went to workshops, got even better equipment, got a large format camera. And it just is something that just has grown throughout my life. It's always been my second thing to do. I have a career still, but whenever I have a chance, I do more photography.
So I'm struck by what you said about being able to see better through the lens of a camera. Can you kind of elaborate on that? And maybe if it helps to elaborate, maybe an example of some of the images that you captured. What are you able to see when you're behind that camera lens that you're not necessarily able to notice, you know, in just the day-to-day movement of life?
Well, as soon as you look through a camera lens, you're now creating something that's abstract. You're not capturing reality. Reality is too big. And when you're experiencing reality, you're experiencing all senses, all five senses at once. But when you're looking through a camera and getting a photograph, you're framing the world. You're framing a very small part of the world. And the minute you frame it, you're bringing something to it because you've chosen that to show. And you could tilt the camera one way or another or back up or move forward or change the lens settings, and you could dramatically change what's in that frame and create design, show texture, show perspective, and make what's in the lens something. And as soon as you've done that, you've now, as someone said earlier, in the sharing section, you've now brought your personality, you've brought your life, your uniqueness to that image. And you've brought the world's attention to this little thing that was within your range of eyesight and within what the camera can do. And it calls attention often to something that no one would look at normally. Your eyes might be averted or you just wouldn't see it. And it's such a delight for me to do that for myself. You know, I thought of it as in Midsummer Night's Dream, Puck had that magic potion that he would put on the eyes of sleeping people, and when they awoke, they would fall in love with whatever they first saw. And to me, working with a camera is working with that magic potion that you're sort of putting it on your own eyes as you take the picture. And if the picture works and causes a response from the viewer, you're basically doing the same thing with the viewer. You're helping them fall in love with what's in the world.
Wow. So poetic. It's really beautiful. And it also makes me think about my own experiences in going to photography exhibits. And, you know, sometimes I would wonder if photographs were altering reality. But the way that you describe it, it's not altering reality. It's just bringing another layer of reality to your consciousness and to the viewer. Because there's so many, you know, we don't really see what's before us. It's just, we see it through our, it's filtered through our own experiences and our own senses in that present moment. And so what you're able to do is bring a whole new perspective to that moment that might have escaped many of us or most of us. And that's really amazing.
I find it amazing. And if you look at the photograph, if you have a screen up called Red Cheeks, which took in Shandong Province in 1986, I was staying at this village, and you don't see the whole room that we're in. You're seeing a very small fraction. And the way I chose to frame that picture, which I would have to say at the time is very intuitive, not really academic, is I'm just in love with this girl and her red cheeks, and I want that to be the beauty. You know, when you look at the whole room, you wouldn't notice it, but when you look at the photograph, and this is a really good camera that I used. So when you see the print, which is a very large print, you can see every vein, capillary in her cheeks that make it that red. And it's just gorgeous, framed with her red outfit. But then behind her is a kind of line of kids at a moment in time, which is no longer. You wouldn't see the communist star on the hat. Mm. And probably wouldn't necessarily see them dressed as warmly because there was no heat. And then the picture to me takes on this kind of march of history because it looks like a march, the three of them in a row, with some perspective at a moment in time. And if you just looked at the room, it was an interesting place to be in, but you would never have that experience with it without the camera.
She's really adorable and at the same time looks really serious and intense.
Well, definitely she had not seen a Westerner before, so I was the oddity in the room. If she had a camera, she'd be taking my picture.
Did you do that when you were traveling to certain places like this, you know, especially with children, allow them to capture what they're seeing through your lens? Have you had that experience?
No, I haven't. I hadn't done that. The camera was really hard to operate. Mm.
Yeah, yeah.
It was before the age of throwaway cameras and
right,
that sort of thing.
Yeah. So this kind of brings me to a more recent exhibit of yours where you had this opportunity to capture men that are homeless and capture their, help them actually realize their own dignity through the photographs.
Yeah.
And so can you tell us a little bit about that? And if you could start by actually telling us the sort of the seeds that led to that 30 years prior.
Yes. I go back to, again, the mid-80s. I had my large format camera, and I ran down to the Connecticut River. I was living in Middletown, Connecticut, and my son was taking judo, so I had an hour, and I that's how my life was. And I ran down to the riverbank because it was all fogged in, and I was trying to capture a picture of the Wesleyan University crew boats coming by in the fog because I knew that I could hear them out there, but I couldn't see them, and I knew one would come by. So I set up my camera on the riverbank, and I was waiting for one of these boats to come by. And I waited almost 45 minutes, and nothing happened. And out of my left side, I could hear somebody coming down the bike path that I was standing near, and it was a squeak, squeak, squeak. And I was curious, and I looked, and coming out of the fog was this homeless man pushing a shopping cart. And I just, you know, I didn't want to be disturbed, and so I paid no attention to him. I really wanted to get the picture I was trying to get. And he came out of the fog, came up next to me. I stayed under my black hood, which you do with a large format picture, so I wouldn't have to deal with anybody. And he started talking to me. Of course, you know, well, that's quite a camera you've got there. You must be an artist, blah, blah, blah. And I kind of grunted, you know, but didn't engage him. And he said, well, I'm also an artist. I'm a writer. And he pointed to a shopping cart and said, well, all my manuscripts in life are in this cart.
Wow.
Well, that got me out of my cloth, and I looked, and sure enough, there was a whole shopping cart full of handwritten, large 2-inch bundles of work. And I said, "Wow, that's a lot of work." And he said, "Yes, I'm still working on it." And so I got back under my hood quickly, and he said, it was a little quiet, and then he said, "Well, you know, I think." Really, I've come to the conclusion that I'm not an artist. That really, what I am is that I'm an observer with a pencil. And then it was quiet again, and then he kind of walked around behind me. I could hear him, and then as he was leaving, he said, "I suppose the question for you is: Are you an artist or are you an observer with a camera?" And then he kept going, and I came out from under my hood thinking either he's schizophrenic or he's the smartest person I've ever heard, and I'm not sure which, or maybe there's no difference. And then I looked up at him as he was just disappearing into the fog, and he looked back over his shoulder and had this wry smile. Which is one of those photographs that I didn't take, but is still burned in my head. And I think I really, really regretted not taking that picture. But I did turn my attention back to the river and said, you know, what I'm trying to do here has been done before. And I'm not really creating anything. I'm just mimicking art that I've seen. And I took a deep breath and just stopped and decided I wouldn't take the picture. And then right in front of me was this dock. In the portfolio is called Gray Dock. It's in the first row on the left. And that picture had been in front of me for an hour. And I was so busy looking for something that was already predetermined in my head that I hadn't been in the moment enough to see the dock, which in the end is a much better picture than I would have taken of a landscape. And I love that picture, and I've had it up ever since. And I have to credit him with that. And then there's this picture I didn't take, and I didn't see myself as a portrait photographer, and so I didn't even think I could have taken it. But I think it gave me, in the back of my head, a desire to get portraits of homeless men. Not looking, sort of like war. I don't want a picture of the war. I want a picture of what's still beautiful. And that man's face was beautiful. I want I wanted that picture. Almost a year later, I was in Washington, D.C., again, mid-80s, and someone asked if I had seen the Karsh exhibit, and I didn't know who Karsh was, but I said no, and we ran down to this museum because it was a really big exhibit, and it was Karsh's 50th anniversary retrospective. Magnificent in the Washington Portrait Gallery, National Portrait Gallery. And I was stunned by his photographs. They're very dark, very important looking technique, and I just said, oh wow, I would really love to be able to do that, but it involves all kinds of technique, and I'm not a perfectionist. I'm, if anything, an imperfectionist, and I didn't see myself doing that. But I always loved the Monterey Peninsula legacy photographers, the Ed Weston and Wynn Bullock and Ansel Adams. And so I was really so influenced by them that when I had a chance, I moved to Monterey. And as soon as we moved to Monterey, I started meeting people who were associated with all those folks. And they were very generous to their time, and I began to move more. I got better at what I was doing. The craft got better. But then I met Daniel Dixon, and Daniel Dixon is the son of Dorothea Lange, and Dorothea Lange was the prominent photographer in the Depression era. So I got very familiar with her work through her son and stories of how she did her work, where she was working with Depression-era people, and she was capturing the horror of the Depression. But look carefully, her faces, faces and hands, carry a nobility that is beyond the normal photograph of a human being. And I think that's really what works in those photographs. And although the technique is different than Karsh, Karsh was capturing the powerful people of the world, showing their strength. She was capturing the most destitute people and capturing their strength. And those were, and I think in the back of my head, along with the homeless man whose picture I missed, I was predisposing myself to a moment that happened 2 years ago in which I was asked at my church to photograph some of the men who were in a homeless program that uses our church one night a month. So one night a month, 30 men come in, we serve them dinner, they sleep on the floor, they're up and gone the next morning. And another church, another night, and another church the next night. So 28 churches provide a safe, warm place and a good meal every day. And as long as these men are trying to make their way back to society, they can use that program. The program has been going on for 20 years, but most of us in the church, although we know we do it, we don't have much to do with it. We don't know who these men are. We maybe deliver food and someone serves it, and you know it's there, and we're happy we're doing it, but there's no personal connection. So they wanted a personal connection. So I said, "Yeah, okay, I'm not a portrait photographer, but I'll take some pictures." Mm-hmm. So I went to a dinner with these men, and I asked if any of them would volunteer, and three of them did, and I took their pictures, and I brought them back the next month, and I gave them prints, and I gave them electronic copies. And they were just so thrilled. And I was so thrilled because the camera became a tool for conversation. It was a tool for an intimate moment with them that happened very fast. So once they volunteered, I was then with them. And I was in that moment, and so were they. And we were working on something together, and then we succeeded in getting something that was who they were on paper. And they were so thrilled because no one had taken their picture except maybe a photojournalist who was trying to make it look as bad as possible. And I took it as a way of, you know, without even thinking, I just took it like, I want to see the best of this person.
Mm-hmm.
And it turned out no one had done that. No one had done it 5 years, 10 years, 20 years. And no one had actually looked at them. And so the whole experience just became magical for me and for them, and they began to say so.
Wow. If I could just jump in, can you delve into a little bit more of that process? Because I know when I read your interview with Richard, you know, in the beginning as you were, as you first went in as a photographer and asked for volunteers, most of the guys weren't even enthusiastic about being photographed.
No.
And then as some of them kind of reluctantly said, okay, sure. And, you know, in the beginning, they had like this rough exterior or
yes,
feelings.
They wear a mask like all of us do.
So how did you, I'm just like really amazed by this ability to break through that mask. And I think I'm getting a sense that it comes from your own innate desire to see the beauty in anything, as you described in Vietnam in the midst of war, you know, you were still seeing beauty there. And so I don't think just anyone can go behind the lens of a camera and transform what could be seen as like a really terrible situation to be in and then see the beauty in that situation or in that individual and bring out that dignity and that feeling of self-worth. And so I don't know if you could talk a little bit more about that process as you were capturing these images and how they changed over the process from the mask to who that person really is.
Well, I think when I look back on it, I had been predisposed all my life to be able to do this pretty naturally. Working in community organizing, I learned very quickly as a stranger in a community that was full of fear and anger and sometimes hatred, it was very easy to not be accepted. And I found, and I learned actually fairly consciously, that you're dealing with people of all status as a community organizer, everywhere from bank president and mayor to the person who's got the least in the community and feels most unempowered. And the only way you can communicate across all those statuses in society is to see yourself. If you think of society as a deck of cards from two up to king and queen, we have a society that has people at all those statuses. And you have, as a community organizer, you have to see yourself as a 10. You have to see yourself as competent, but not royalty. You have to be able, worthy, but nothing less, nothing more. And then you have to look at everybody else as a 10. And you have to forget everything you know about royalty and what's expected. And you have to forget everything you know about unempowered people and what's expected. And you have to forget about all the stereotypes of color and religion and everything. And you have to face your head and deal with the moment with that person and deal with them as if they were a 10. That's how you survive as a community organizer. There's no other way you would make it. No one wants to watch you suck up to royalty. No one wants to see you treat anybody as less than a 10. I think it's a global human need. And when I got face to face with my camera with these guys, I had to forget everything I know. They are a 10. I'm a 10. I'm good. They're good. Now let's start there. And they had a mask for sure. I couldn't notice it. that was not what I was going to photograph.
Mm-hmm.
And as I kept clicking and asked them to move in a different way, I'd say, you know, move that shoulder in a little closer to my camera and kick your chin up just a bit. Oh, you know, that is a beautiful jawline right there.
Wow.
Just that admission that I feel some love or affection for that person.
Yeah.
The way he looks is such an unusual thing, and they would like jut the jaw up a little more even, you know, and I say, oh yeah, but I'm missing your other eye, so come on around, Jed. There it is. Gorgeous. You know,
mm-hmm.
eyes even on black and white are different, you know, and they say, wow, this guy has noticed my eye color, he's noticed my jawline, he's noticed my nose, he's noticed my lips, he's noticed my hair, my hands. All of a sudden, this is a totally different experience. And it feels safe. There's no one else there. And then I'll say, okay, I really like what we've got. But take a break here. Let me change the battery on my camera. I come up with something. Take a break. And then I just start chatting. You know, do you have kids? Mm. Were you married? Are you... You know, what were you doing before? And then as they start talking, they would have natural expression.
Oh,
and uh-huh. Say, okay, oh, whoa. Stay right there. That magnificent. What'd you say your daughter's name? And they say, Elise. Bang, there's the picture.
Wow.
So it...
go ahead.
It's that sort of interaction. And then I would run around. I get so excited, I would... I am naturally. Oh my goodness! And then they get excited and they have even more expression, and it's sort of circular until we get it. And then I run around with the camera and I show them the back of the camera, which of course is an advantage. Never before in history could you do that. And they turn and they say, "Oh my God, that's me!"
Wow.
Well, it is. But I said, that's the picture I want for an exhibit, but why don't you click back and see if there's something you like more?
Mm.
And they'll click back, and they're clicking back the last 20 minutes and probably seeing 100 pictures of themselves. And when they get back to the beginning, they see the masks they came in with.
That is such an incredible gift that you've given these men. It's so inspiring and moving. And the exhibit is about to, has it started already? Or
no, it's going to open September 5th in Carmel at a very nice gallery called the Cherry Center in Carmel. And we have, I've taken the 25 images that I like the best. And a lot of them, I mean, every one of these pictures has a story. I mean, it's just mind-boggling. Mm-hmm. And then whenever I showed anybody one of these pictures, I haven't showed them very broadly, but the people would say, well, how could he be homeless? How could that man be homeless? How could he be living alone? What's the story? So I had this 8-year-old girl from church who wants to be a writer. 2 years ago, she was 14, and she came in and worked with me, and she interviewed all these guys and wrote essays about them. So we'll have the photograph, but we'll also have an essay.
Yeah.
Then we realized we should have these guys telling their own stories, so we have a video artist who has videoed 7 of them who were willing to go on video for like 2 hours each and tell the story of their lives, and he's narrowed that down to 3 minutes, which will be accessible in the gallery by augmented reality, which means if you point your device, your digital device, at one of my pictures, the video of this guy will come out, and he'll become kind of live and telling his own story. So it's a multimedia exhibit. It'll be there for 5 weeks, and then we're going to start thinking about where else in the world we could take the show.
That's incredible. And before I go on, I wanted to let the callers know that it is 6 past 10 o'clock. So if anyone wanted to ask their own question to Bob, you can just press star 6.
Hi, Bella. I have a question, if I may ask. So, Bob, one of your comments stuck with me, and that was that when you're looking at a person through camera, it's a completely, or maybe not completely, but it's a different experience from what you would see with a naked eye. And they just reminded me of the focus and being in the moment and just that connection from inside that is so empowering to see the person and things around the person in a different light. The question I have is, how has this photography and the entire experience has impacted you personally?
It has affected me monumentally, I have to say. I never saw myself as a portrait photographer, and now I'm a portrait photographer. I mean, it makes so much sense. I'm not a landscape photographer. My whole life has been interacting and empowering people, basically. And what happened in this project was the consolidation of my hobby and my vocation into one thing. This is an enormous empowerment tool. I had seen photography as an art of helping people see something differently, but then I realized its importance is probably even greater as a therapeutic tool, as a way of bringing new life to people, and not just the person whose picture I'm taking, or not just to me, but if it works, it will be to anyone who views the photographs, because it destroys the stereotype. The stereotype that we bring to the word homelessness, that most of the time people will look at a homeless person with either enormous sympathy or enormous disdain. It's a dramatic reaction. But if you look at these photographs and then realize these are homeless people also, you have to broaden what. And destroy that stereotype. It doesn't work. You have to think of this person in a whole new way. And the social implications of this are huge.
Correct. So that's an amazing insight. I have one more question that I'd like to ask. But before that, I would just remind all of our callers, if you have a question for Bob, or if you'd like to share a thought, or if you have a reflection, if you press star 6 on your telephone keypad, and it will put you in a Q&A queue. So, and thank you for that answer, Bob. And I have one more question, and that is, as a photographer, you mentioned that sometimes you have to keep an open mind or an open eye to see things differently from your preconceived notion of what it is or how it should be. And at the same time, it's your creativity, it's your inside connection that is bringing power to the moment and to the photograph. So what goes in your mind, and how do you focus, and how do you stay in the moment when you are taking pictures? If you just take us through that a little bit.
Sure. I think every one of these guys, when I go get them, I have a special space set aside in the church with a temporary studio that I've brought in for the night, and I go get them, and because they've said they would be interested, and I bring them in, and it's quite awkward because they're walking into these beautiful, these big lights, and it's dark, and they're sitting in this new light, and I have to get a release form signed, and you know the business of it all is awkward. But once they're behind the lights and I'm behind the camera and I look through the lens, I am in a different space completely, because now everything else, all my equipment, the rest of the room, the rest of the world is gone. All I can see is this human being in this gorgeous light, and then I carefully begin directing, and I'll say, I'm just going to shoot for a while to get the lighting right. You know, could you do this? Could you do that? You know, when this is not important. This is just, you know, but I no longer see a homeless person. I don't see a famous person. I just see a person. I have no idea really what he or she is all about. I am just completely into that moment. There is nothing else in my head. And then I'll see something I like. I'll ask, or I suspect, and I ask for a particular movement. And then I begin to understand this person's face, and I begin to see where it would look really good. And I want the hands, because the hands are so expressive. So I try to get them someplace where you could see the hands in the picture, and then I give them a break, and then I start a conversation, and then it is in the conversation that I see what I want, really.
Mm.
And freeze that and play with that until we get it.
How touching to just to hear that once you're behind the camera and the person is sitting there, suddenly you are looking at that person for who he or she is, and it's coming in the moment. With service space, we talk about holding the space and sharing the journey from heart. And it's just so inspiring that for you, it just the experience of getting behind the camera and just doing that is doing that for you. Thank you for your answer, Bob. I think we have one caller on the queue, and so let's get to our next caller here.
Hi, I'm Karen. I'm sorry I couldn't be heard at the beginning, but I'm a photographic artist with image and text and a teacher, and I will be hoping to get in touch with you as a possible exhibit at our school. But one of the things that I wanted to ask you to reflect on is, first of all, the work and your description of your process is so very moving and beautiful. One of the critiques of what I'll just loosely call liberal photography is that we trigger emotional responses, but that there isn't any connection to social activism or change. And I wonder, given your background with community organizing and everything, if you have any thoughts about the connection of this work and the changes that need to happen so that the world will work for everyone.
Well, what a great
Thank
question.
You.
Thank you. Yes, so this is sort of in the category of how everything just sort of came together. After I've done now about 60 of these portraits over the two-year period, and right in the middle of the last 2 years, when the government, federal government, went into sequestration and then government shutdown, federal money for this program that got these men to our churches just stopped dead. And so these 30 men were about to be back out on the street. And because the churches provide the place to sleep and the meal, which is about $1 million of in-kind contribution a year. But the federal government was putting up the money for the bus to get them there and a counselor to sleep with them at night and that sort of thing. And although it wasn't a lot of money, probably about $60,000 a year, it was gone in a flash. And so I turned this into a slideshow, and we took it on the road to the churches, to Rotary groups, to everybody we could, City Hall. And people saw these pictures, and they said, oh, these are the people that federal money was helping. Well, we didn't mean to stop that, right? Mm-hmm. It was like, oh, yeah, oh, these people should get help. Well, mm-hmm. all right, federal money is gone. So we were able to raise enough money to put the program back in place before the money ran out. So we had we realized this in late February, and the program was about to close down in 30 days. And in 30 days, we had a new corporation. We had a 501c3 applied for. Someone was collecting the money, and we put enough money in place to get the program back in place for a year. And this exhibit is a fundraiser. So everything, we've got a book, we've got lectures, we have a theater piece, and everything we make on this, all the profit will go straight to the program. And then we'll keep moving the exhibit around to keep raising money for it. And it has taken the program to a new level. We turned a crisis into something that is really, really good. And the photographs played a key role in building not sympathy and not a negative reaction, but empathy. And the empathy has led to money. And it actually has led to a change in public policy.
Wow. Incredible. We have another caller. Just one second.
Hi, Bob. Thank you so much for your reflections. I had a question, actually, which was so connected to the answer you just gave. I wanted to just pick up on the theme of the call today, which is, you know, using art as a tool for healing and for transformation. And a personal interest I have is art connected to community. And I think you pretty much answered it, but I just kind of wanted to hear from you what you feel is a process for healing, and you know, what is it that heals when you use your beautiful tool of photography. So, and as healing happens on so many levels, personally for you as well as, you know, individuals that you work with, and then at the level of community. So just wanted to understand a little more what you think about that and what that means to you.
Yeah, there have been so many wonderful things that have happened in getting around to speak about this and to show the slides. Following a talk of 2 to 30 or 40 people, I'll get immediately more people wanting me to speak in more places. So we get this viral effect. And a lot of the people in the audiences are older people who are very conservative politically. And I've been struck by their willingness to just drop everything and offer help. People offering to come in and help write resumes, people willing to beauticians willing to have people do hair. All of the men will say to me when I go to take their picture, you can't let me smile because I don't have my teeth. So I've got dentists saying I would take one or two a month. You know, I can do that.
Oh, that's amazing.
And so I just walk away from that thinking, you know, this has enormous power. That goes beyond the normal political boundaries. And in our town, I showed them at a city council meeting because the council was about to pass a no parking overnight ban anywhere in town in order to get the homeless out of their cars in town. And I showed the pictures, and instead what the council did was to come up with what they called the Pacific Grove Challenge to other towns, where they put $1 per person in town aside. So we've got 18,000 people. They put $18,000 in a fund and said they would contribute it to the program if every other town around them would do the same thing. And then they went around and talked to all the other councils. And four other city councils have now committed the same thing. So now we've got 100-some thousand in city money available for these programs that wasn't there before. So it has enormous power.
Yeah. Wow, incredible. But when you're talking about even how this has had an impact on policy and on the minds of policymakers and the hearts of policymakers, it makes me think of something I read on your blog about your work in management consulting and these workshops you've been doing, moving from left brain to right brain. And you wrote that although most of what I do with clients requires right brain function, relationship building, teaming, conflict management, visioning, communicating, there's a tendency to go native. My clients are very intensely left brain centric with a strong dislike for anything that crosses over from the right brain hemisphere. It's not a benign dislike. It's a very aggressive, polarized, and polarizing style. And so can you talk more about that, these workshops and what you've observed in the participants as they're shifting or realizing the benefit maybe of being able to bridge in between the right and left brain in their work?
Yes, I have two things that I'm doing now that I think are the most powerful to get that work done. One is kind of goes under the guise of team building or intervention when things aren't going well with a group, and I do what has been done before a lot. I think something called Lifeline, where I ask them a week ahead of time to do a graph of their life, both their career and their personal life, and the graph shows when things in their life was just kind of okay and when it was really positive and when it was really negative. And they come in with this graph, and I give them half an hour to explain the graph to the group, both their personal and career life. And it takes all day for 10 people to do that. And to debrief it, but it has been one of the most stunning experiences they ever have had at work. And in many cases, they've worked with people 5, 10, 15 years and just didn't know particularly the bad moments. I've heard of everything now from loss of children to suicide attempts to being in jail to... And once they've shared that, it cracks through a lot of the belligerence about touchy-feely stuff. They realize there is no point in working with people without knowing this stuff, because once you see it, you understand so much more about why that person is the way they are. You don't have to be a shrink to know that if you grew up that way, of course you're going to be abrupt. I mean, there's no need to take that personally. So that is one piece that I'm doing a lot now. Doing another one next week at Yahoo. And then the other is executive presence. So I'll work with 10 or 12 executives, usually an intact work team. They bring in a 5 to 7 minute pitch that is important, that they need to get support to do something that with people they don't control, and I videotape them doing that, and then I work with them and open them up to a way of presenting whoever they are in a much more likable and authentic way. And when they then see that coaching on video, they very quickly realize that what they thought they were projecting was not, and what they needed to project is something else. And that, again, I'm using all the theater arts. I'm using improvisation, drama, dance, and voice and storytelling.
Wow.
Hi. I was noticing that you've been speaking to many different audiences about your work. Have you had much luck in speaking to college age or young audiences about this?
Yes, I've not had any. I've had the same reaction everywhere. I've not been to high school level or below yet, but I would love to try it. But everybody else has been the same. Older people, college age doesn't really matter.
Okay. Well, I guess we're approaching the end of our time here, but I've learned so much in this conversation with you, and it's just been a wonderful way to start off my Saturday in such a profound and reflective way. So thank you so much for sharing your experiences with us and your incredible photography. And we will be sharing links to your website and to your upcoming exhibit in Carmel with the callers, as well as the larger service-based community. And I have a feeling there's going to be many ripples from this call and requests for your exhibit to be shared in other spaces. I already have a couple of ideas in my mind, so...
Well, thank you so much for the opportunity. I really appreciate it, and your questions were great, and so was the question from the rest of the group.
I would like to ask one last question, Bob, and that is what we all can do for you. Maybe the service-based community and all the volunteers, how can we help you in your journey that is so inspiring?
Well, I think one of the things I'm most interested in is every group I've talked to, especially the retired executive groups, have said immediately, how do we scale this? And I have been so busy, I haven't given much thought to that. But I think it does scale. I think there are great photographers all over the world who could easily do this if they chose to. And I would love to see more people do it. I would love to provide any information if it would be of any help to anyone to do it. And I think there are many unempowered groups. I've already been approached by groups of people like groups that are helping prisoners who are about to be let out of jail, people who are working with teenagers trying to keep them out of jail, high-risk populations, people who are just generally at the lower status of society and struggling to have a life. And I think all of those are great populations that we could help, and I think there are a lot of artists, not only photographers, but photography has some unique advantages, and I would just like to see this spread globally.
How touching, how touching. Yeah, we will love to help you spread the thought, and we have a few other channels like Daily Good and Phil Ways that we can spread the positive news, and so once we have the recording and the transcription, we'll see ways as to how we could use this to inspire others and make an impact that way as well. At this point, let's have a minute of gratitude, a minute of silence. How grateful we are for this call. And so thank you, Bob, and thank you, all of our callers. At this point, I'm going to unmute all of us. And on count of three, let's say thank you, Bob. One, two, three. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Awake and Call.